The CIS benchmarks are secure configuration recommendations for hardening specific technologies in an organization's environment. Each benchmark is the product of an ongoing consensus project involving the generous volunteer efforts of subject matter experts, technology vendors, public and private community members, academics, and the CIS benchmarks development team. CIS benchmarks are a key component of an organization's overall security against cyber attacks, and each CIS benchmark recommendation maps to the CIS critical security controls, or CIS controls. There are more than 100 CIS benchmarks across 25 plus vendor product families available through free PDF download for non-commercial use. CIS benchmarks coverage includes security guidelines that are applicable to cloud provider platforms and cloud services, containers, databases, desktop software, server software, mobile devices, network devices, and operating systems. Learn more about CIS benchmarks by visiting CISECURITY.org/benchmarks.
Barcode Podcast with your host, Chris Glandon, serving cybersecurity straight up with no chaser. Let's hit the bar and grab a drink.
Hey, Boozbot, how you been, man?
Not bad, Chris. I've been working on sharpening my threat hunting skills.
Nice. I didn't know you were into that.
Affirmative. I enjoy the challenge of tracking down dangerous threats, and the pure satisfaction of knowing that I'm helping to keep humans and organizations safe from harm. Not to mention, the adrenaline rush.
Speaking of rush, I'm in a rush. Let me just get a shot of Jaeger.
Perfect. The name Jägermeister in German literally means master hunter. It is a title for a high-ranking official in charge of matters related to hunting. I'm going to make you a Jaeger bomb. Fill a shot glass with 1.5 ounces Jägermeister. Then, pour half a can of Red Bull into a pint glass. Drop the shot glass into the pint glass, and drink immediately.
Hey, I gotta run, man. I got a true threat hunter and intel expert in my crosshairs that I need to talk to.
Proceed. I'll see you next round.
Crane Hasselt is the Director of Threat Intelligence at Abnormal Security, where he leads a team responsible for researching enterprise-focused phishing threats. Prior to moving to the private sector in 2015, Crane served as an analyst at the FBI for more than 11 years, spending most of his career in the Behavioral Analysis Unit supporting national security and serial violent crime investigations. Crane, thanks for stopping by Barcode.
All right, Chris, it's good to be here.
I'm also joined by Dr. Matt Canham. Hey, Matt.
Hello.
So Crane, if you wouldn't mind, talk to us a little bit about your background and how you transitioned from being an intelligence analyst with the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit working on violent offenders to becoming the Director of Threat Intelligence for Abnormal.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, my background, you know, in the cyber realm, you know, I think a lot of people think of cyber threats as these technically sophisticated things, but my background is actually in psychology and behavioral analysis. And, you know, that's what, you know, I studied in college. And then after I graduated, moved over to the FBI, where I primarily was doing intelligence analysis, started out in financial crimes, and then moved down to the behavioral analysis units, where they all do the fun, you know, behavioral analysis stuff, the classical serial killer profiling and things like that, which was really in my wheelhouse. And what was interesting is during my time, my first few years there, I started sort of working on leading a team that was working on a database that was meant to compare and link serial violent crimes across state lines And there was this big migration to move the database from this old school client server system to a web-based database. And so as I was doing that, I got familiar with understanding how databases work, understanding, you know, what, you know, some of the contractors and the builders that are building the back end of this database were doing. And that was really, you know, my initial foray into quote unquote cyber, which is not too cybery, but you know, it has to do with computers. And so that was really where things got started. But then one of the things that I helped do a few years later was build out the FBI's Cyber Behavioral Analysis Center, which really takes all those concepts that have been used for decades in the violent crime profiling world and applies them to cyber threats and cyber threat actors to really look at these threats from a very different perspective, from a more behavioral perspective, from a more human perspective. And what was great about the way that we built that team is we built it very holistically. So there were three of us in the sort of the core when we first started it, and each one of us really had our own subject matter expertise and background. So mine was sort of intelligence analysis and open source analysis. We had one of the agents who's probably one of the best malware agents in the entire bureau. So he came with the pure technical background. And then we had another agent who I always joke could barely work a computer. And I think he would probably say the same thing. But he had decades of experience in the behavioral analysis realm. And so each of us came together to build out sort of the team. And it was really as we were building out that team that I got sort of the on the job training of understanding the cyber threat landscape, understanding how various types of cyber threats work. And, you know, as we were building out our capabilities, you know, it was all about sort of on the go type of a learning experience, which honestly helps. I really like doing things, learning about things hands on. And that's really where we were able to do. And so I left the FBI back in 2015 and moved out to the private sector. And helped build out my first sort of private sector cyber threat intelligence team, primarily focused on credential phishing, understanding how those types of attacks work. I was at that company called Phish Labs for about 3 years, moved to another company called Agari, where I pretty much did the very similar thing, focused on building out a threat intelligence team from the ground up. This time it was mainly focused on sort of enterprise focused phishing threats and BEC attacks. And then a few years later, I moved over to where I am now at Abnormal, where I, one more time, for the third time, I'm building a threat intel team from the ground up. Something I really like doing. I love building things. It's so gratifying to be able to sort of build something that wasn't there before and have the sense of accomplishment of when you're able to make an impact, not just within the company you're working for, but also on a higher level as we work with external third parties, law enforcement, and things like that, to try to impact the threats that we're researching on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm curious about threat intelligence, and you've built you're on three teams now, is that correct? That you've built in the process of building?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to assume that you probably know a little bit about threat intelligence at this point. Can you explain what threat intelligence is and maybe give sort of the sales pitch for why a company might need threat intelligence?
Yeah, so the whole purpose of threat intelligence is better understanding not only threats that an organization may be facing, but also understanding which threats I should invest time and money in prioritizing over other threats, right? So depending on what company you work for or what industry you're in, you know, BEC may be the biggest threat that I want to focus on because it could cause so much direct financial loss, right? That's a sort of money is going straight out the door. Whereas there are other organizations, healthcare is a great one, where at the top of your food chain of list of priorities and risks, ransomware might be on there. Because as an organization, I need to have constant access to my data, to patient data 24/7. And if I lose access to that data, it's going to be debilitating for my organization. And then you might be in something like aerospace or maybe a defense contractor where your primary risk is probably not cybercrime. It's probably a national security risk where you're trying to make sure that you're securing your intellectual property. And so threat intelligence is all about understanding your risk posture as an organization. And then once you've understood what you're prioritizing, digging into those threats to better understand how they not only work today, but how they're evolving and what tomorrow's threats might look like that I need to start getting ahead of.
And when you talk about threat intelligence, let me ask, is there, because you previously had talked about sort of the human side, is there sort of a differentiator there between technical threat intelligence and what you might term human threat intelligence, like looking at the actors themselves?
Yeah, so I think when you're talking about threat intelligence, right? So when you're talking about more technical threat intelligence, it's going to be more tactical in nature, right? So it's going to be about digging into a specific thing. In this case, a lot of the malware analysis you see out there is very tactical in nature. It's about breaking down a piece of malware, understanding how it works, understanding how it's going to be exploiting a system. And it's very sort of compartmentalized, right? Whereas when you're talking about human threat intelligence or understanding the actors behind certain types of attacks, then you're moving into more strategic threat intelligence, understanding the bigger picture, understanding what's motivating an actor to potentially go after your organization or some other organization. And so it is very different, sort of the human side of threat intelligence. But the biggest component of understanding behavior, understanding people and how they fit in to various cyber threats is really looking at the attacks from a very different perspective. And it's about, you know, understanding that regardless of the type of cyber threat you may be looking at, the very first thing that an attacker has to do in almost all circumstances is exploit human behavior, right? So even if it's a malicious attachment, a malicious payload, it's going to be, you know, you need to get someone to click on that payload, to open up that attachment, to bypass existing defenses. And then it sort of exploits it technically. So at the end of the day, almost every cyber threat is still based in exploiting human behavior.
Gotcha. Let me ask you this. Since your expertise in human and behavioral analysis runs so deep, do you find it difficult to disconnect the business side from the personal side, or is there only one side, whereas the understanding of an individual's way of thinking is a continuous research study for you?
You know, it's interesting. I don't really, it's, you know, especially because prior to the cyber stuff, I was in sort of the violent crime world, and living in that world for a number of years, you get really good at compartmentalizing things. So, you know, I've never had a problem sort of separating the personal world and the work world when it comes to everything. What I think has been, I don't think challenging, but probably eye-opening, is especially given the work that that my team at Abnormal does, looking at business email compromise attacks and the other types of scams that are associated with those. And we've gotten to know much more about the actors behind those scams. And it's been really eye-opening to better understand their motivations, right? So a lot of these actors are coming from places like West Africa, Nigeria, and understanding why they do what they do. And for the most part, it's really how they make a living. It's how they survive. And you put really a human face on what seems to be just a massively impactful financial attack, it contextualizes it in a way that makes you think twice about, you know, how bad of a threat is this really, mm-hmm. right? Because you have people who need to make money. They can't make money in any other legitimate way because of the economy, because of their environment. And it makes you think, you know, it makes you sort of it gives you that empathy for some of these cyber criminals, which is something that I don't think a lot of people think about, especially the cyber world, because, you know, because of its nature, there is no person in front of you committing a crime. It is all, you know, somewhat invisible that you could have an attacker that's on the other side of the world. You know nothing about that attacker. You know nothing about that person's background or motivations or, you know, what they're doing in their life. All you know is what you're seeing from the actual attack. And when you are able to understand the human side of it, you know, it's just really interesting, and it sort of provides a different context that you don't really see on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I'm going to confess, I was at your Demonware presentation at DEF CON, and it was phenomenal, by the way, and it kind of segues from what you were just talking about. And I'm curious, can you walk us through that? But before you actually tell the story itself, I'm really curious to know a little bit more about the motivation behind how you set that up. And what I'm referring to specifically is sort of this idea of sock puppet accounts or active defense that you use to kind of start that engagement. So if you don't mind, start there, and then we'll get into the story itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So active defense is something that my teams have done really for the past about 4 years or so, primarily because the world that the threats that we're focused on are things like business email compromise. Business email compromise, BEC, is really unique in the cyber threat landscape because in order for it to be successful, it generally requires an actual back and forth communication between the attacker and the victim. And because of that, it allows us an opportunity to really get in the middle of that attack and collect some really unique intelligence that helps us better understand how these attacks unfold, what happens after the attacks. And so one of the things that my team does is we've built an entire ecosystem based on, you know, hundreds of different personas that we've built that essentially whenever we see a BEC attack in our collection, we will actually make one of these personas look like they were the target of one of the BEC attacks. And we initiate that engagement. And the whole purpose of that is to better understand what happens after one of these attacks is successful. You know, so many times in cyber threat intelligence, what we rely on is really what the attackers give us. And that's usually the initial email. And so active defense allows us to go a step further and have that engagement, have that conversation with an attacker to understand what are they actually asking for? What would the potential impact of this attack, what would it have been? You know, understanding how they're going to adapt to certain obstacles we throw in their way when we say that, no, we can't make a payment to this account. What are they going to do next? We also are able to get some good high-level attribution by embedding beacons in these messages that allows us to understand, you know, where the attackers are coming from. So it gives us a much more holistic understanding of things like BEC threats because we're doing this back and forth engagement. And so, you know, so active defense, the definition that I use is, you know, engaging with an attack or an attacker for the purposes of better understanding that threat and using that intelligence so we can better prepare and defend against those threats. And so active defense is really this unique way that we do it. And, you know, because we've also scaled it out on our team, you know, we've automated about 75% of the entire process. We're able to do tens of thousands of these engagements that really gives us a really good representative understanding of what's actually happening in the global BEC threat landscape.
Oh, that's excellent. It's interesting that Chris and I interviewed Brett Johnson, who's a convicted cyber criminal. And one of the things that he talks about when he was scamming victims online is that he would anticipate sort of the barbs or the pushback that they might have if they became suspicious. And he would sort of get out ahead of that by putting the onus on the victim of like, well, how can I trust you? You know, how do I know you're not scamming me here? And it's interesting that you're using similar tactics essentially on the criminals themselves by sort of anticipating how they're going to respond to these things and like one step ahead. It's almost like this Red Queen arms race between the two sides. That being said, can you tell us about the engagement that you had with Demonware?
Yeah. So this was last year, and this was most of the time when we're doing active defense engagements, it is with BEC actors. But last year we actually came across an attack where you had an actor that was, instead of requesting sort of the same, a payment or impersonating a CEO, requesting sort of an outgoing wire transfer, the attacker was essentially emailing employees and soliciting them to try to install Demonware ransomware on a corporate server. And as part of that, they said that if you help me, I'll give you 40% of the proceeds. And so in this email, the attacker provided a Telegram account and an email account to contact back if any employees were interested. And so this gave us a great opportunity to sort of employ some active defense tactics to better understand this attacker, understand how this would have unfolded if it were successful. And so, so I created a persona Telegram account and actually messaged the attacker. And within 30 minutes, he got back to me and essentially repeating what he said in the email. And that sort of led to an extended conversation back and forth on Telegram, where I was able to learn things like, where they got their targeting information from, which, he said that all the targeting information came from LinkedIn, which is not out of the ordinary, which is something we see very commonly, especially in BEC attacks, where you have legitimate commercial services, that the same commercial services that sales and marketing teams use to identify sales prospects are the same services that a lot of these BEC actors are using to identify potential targets. So I was able to get things like understanding where they got targeting information from, understanding that the amount that they were asking for is extremely flexible, based on the amount that he referred to in the initial email. You could sort of calculate it's going to be about a $2.5 million ransom he was going to be asking for. But over the course of, my conversation with him, it was essentially moving down and down and down, and he eventually got to like $120,000 pretty quickly. And so it really shows you that, they are relatively flexible in the amount of money that they're making. A lot of this, because it is so significantly financially motivated, they're just looking to make as much money as possible, as quickly as possible. And regardless of whether it's $120,000 or $2.5 million, any amount in between there would have been absolutely life-changing for this guy. Understanding the flexibility in the amount that he's asking for, understanding where the code actually came from for this malware, and also sort of seeing what his response would be. So before the actual engagement, I was able to get a copy of Demonware, understanding where it's coming from. Demonware is actually open source ransomware that's available on GitHub. And what's interesting is when, I ended up asking him during this engagement, where did you get this? Did you make this from scratch? And he said, oh yeah, I coded it myself from Python. And what's interesting is these are the types of questions that where we already know the answer to them, that we will ask them just to see what they'll say. So we already knew that this was open source malware, but based on his response, it's obvious that he, was trying to make himself look more technically sophisticated than he actually was. And so there were a number of different things that we were able to get out of that. And then the best part about this is at sort of near the tail end of the initial engagement with this guy, essentially, as sort of a, quote unquote employee that's, trying to help out and is a little bit nervous about helping out with his possible ransomware deployment, one of the things that I said to him was, I'm a little scared here. How do I know that you're not going to screw me over and, report me to the authorities? And, his response was, well, you don't need to worry about that. Look, I'm just a guy. I'm trying to build out my own social networking company. Here's my LinkedIn profile, which actually was a link to his actual LinkedIn profile. He was based out of Nigeria, had his actual name on it. And the weird thing about that is it makes you think that sometimes attribution is really easy. All you need to do is just ask them who they are, and sometimes they'll just tell you. It's kind of surprising. But, you know, so at the end of the day, at the end of this engagement that lasted a couple of days, you know, we got a lot of much more robust understanding of how a threat like this, how an attack like this would have unfolded. We understand much more about his motivation, more about, obviously, we understood who he is, where he's coming from. And that's really at the core of active defense, is to help us better understand the full cycle of a threat and not just the initial email.
So I'm curious what you took from that engagement, both in terms of, you know, professional knowledge, or I should say threat intelligence, and then also kind of on the personal side. You mentioned that this is how people basically make their livings, and that they are disadvantaged economically pretty severely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so from an overall sort of, from the, just a pure threat intelligence perspective, it's super helpful for us to understand, you know, overall what they're asking for and how this deployment would have worked, right? So that's like pure tactical defense. But then from a strategic perspective, it helps us understand, you know, where the gaps are, and, you know, externally, where that might be a threat to us. Obviously, when we're talking about impersonation attacks, you know, an attacker needs to get the basic information about certain identities, whether it's targeted employees or executives that they're going to be impersonating. And so what's helpful about this, and this has been sort of reiterated over and over again in previous engagements that I've done, is, you know, these external data brokers or even things like LinkedIn are essentially the primary source of where a lot of these guys are getting their targeting activity. So, you know, making sure that from a strategic perspective, that, you know, making sure to advise executives or high value targets at organizations to make sure that they are, you know, not exposing information as much as possible out there on the internet, because that's what these guys are going to take advantage of. And then from a human perspective, from a understanding the attacker and the adversary perspective, you know, understanding what their motivation is, right? So when we talk about this guy's motivation, or pretty much any other financially motivated attack, it is so heavily driven by making money. In this case, it's as a way to just go on with life, to provide for themselves and their family. There are certainly actors out there, you know, in the BTC world, Hush Puppy is like the best example that's more recent, where it's more of a lifestyle thing. They want to make a ton of money and be flashing it around social media and things like that. Honestly, a majority of the BTC attacks, the actors that are behind BTC attacks that I see are pretty much in the other camp, that are simply doing it essentially as a job. But understanding the fact that these are so heavily financially motivated, there are two things behind that. One is consequences are only relative to the benefits, right? So if I have to do this to make money, to survive, then it's not really going to matter if U.S. law enforcement may try to arrest me, because quite frankly, it's not going to have, there's so many of these actors out there that their actual exposure and potential risk for law enforcement intervention is relatively low compared to an actor that may be, you know, here in the States, for example. So number one, you have sort of the, you know, the takeaway or understanding how motivation drives consequences and then drives what can we actually do about these attacks. The other side of it is really, you know, the reasons why active defense works. So because these attacks are so heavily financially motivated, in the same way that they try to get their victims to ignore potential red flags that are usually going to pop up in some sort of scam or cyber attack, we're also sort of, their financial motivation is overriding any red flags that may come up in an active defense engagement, right? So, you know, as I mentioned, the personas that we're using to communicate with them, they didn't actually email to begin with. So we're sending them an email from an email account that they've never seen before. And based on our experience, very few of these guys actually compare who they receive emails from and to who they send actually emails to. But so even if they did some checking, and the reasons, you know, when we have these engagements that sometimes last a month, right? And we are collecting dozens of mule accounts from these guys that are never getting paid because we have excuses about why our transactions aren't going through. As long as there is a sliver of hope that they're going to make something out of this, they're going to go on and they're going to stick with this engagement. And, you know, those are some pretty significant red flags that someone has to completely ignore in order to continue with these engagements. And that's really, really shows you how solid the financial motivation is for a lot of these guys.
Does the criminal's motivation affect your level of empathy? And has empathy ever, you know, helped or hurt your analysis process?
No, not really. I mean, so we can stay pretty much level-headed on, you know, sort of decoupling the people behind these attacks and the attacks themselves. You know, like most cyber threats, it's a cat and mouse game. It's always going to be about, you know, defense and, you know, making sure more important than anything else, we're protecting our customers, right? And making sure that our customers are not only protected against the attacks that we're stopping for them, but also understanding how these attacks are evolving through, you know, through our active defense intelligence collection to help them, to help protect them against future attacks, right? And so, you know, while you have a certain level of empathy for some of these guys, you do have the other side of these scams. And so that really removes some of that empathy from the equation. And the greatest example of this is a romance scams. You know, romance scams and business email compromise are very closely linked because most of the mule accounts that are used to receive funds from BEC attacks are usually going to be victims of other types of scams, which are primarily romance scam victims. And so what we've also done, you know, I've done a lot of research and done a lot of engagements with romance scammers as well. And when you look at those scammers and what they do to their victims, your empathy will go out the window because they, not only do they steal all of the money that a victim, a romance victim has, they steal all of the money that they could have through loans. And then once they've essentially dried up that well from a financial perspective, they then convert those romance victims into mules and then continue to use them in other ways. And these victims are sometimes victimized for years. And it is so psychologically traumatic for some of these victims that you've seen, you know, suicides, attempted suicides. And when you see that, understanding how the same scammers that are running, you know, what look to be very basic BEC attacks are also running these romance scams, it really sort of provides that additional layer of perspective that you're like, okay, I'm not that empathetic towards you. You know, understanding how the sausage is made, understanding what else you're doing behind the scenes that is so debilitating and so damaging to a lot of other victims out there, individual victims.
So I'm so happy that you brought up romance scams because this is something I've also looked into a bit. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about some of the psychological tactics that these threat actors are using. And I'll just, a quick example, I also have worked on a lot of gift card scams. And, you know, going through the transcript of the back and forth between the criminal and the victim, it amazed me the level of, I want to say sophistication in how they knew how to push certain buttons to get the victim to move in certain ways at certain times when they needed to be. And I'm curious what you've seen on the BEC side. Have you seen this kind of back and forth pushback? And what are your thoughts on their expertise as psychologists?
So one of the things about today's BEC actors is they essentially come from the same group of individuals for the most part that were behind the old Nigerian print scams 30 years ago. And, you know, funnily enough, I mean, Nigerian print scams are the scams I think you should show most people out there, and they'd be like, what is this? Who would fall for this? Those scams are still around today because the ROI is still there, that they're still making some money. The success rate is clearly not high. But if I'm sending out thousands of emails and I get one hit that nets me a couple thousand dollars, that's pretty easy to do. And, you know, the ROI is still there. And so one of the things you got to keep in mind is that the reason BEC actors sort of flipped the switch over to BEC, which was around 2015, 2016, is for 20, 25 years prior to that, they had gotten really good at social engineering individuals. And when you think about what happened around 2015, 2016, there was this big evolution within the overall cyber threat landscape that shifted away from individuals and toward enterprises and businesses. This, we saw the exact same thing happen in ransomware, where in late 2016, some of the bigger groups, the bigger ransomware groups, Lockheed was the sort of the most prominent one back then, pivoted over to enterprises, primarily hospitals and healthcare centers. And we saw the exact same thing happening in social engineering, where you had these actors, these West African Nigerian actors that had been focused on romance scams, unemployment scams, and things like that, that sort of saw the same thing and said, let's use these exact same tactics to target institutions and businesses. And so there, we're now in essentially the second generation of social engineers in Nigeria that are running these scams as a way to make a living. And there's a very broad sort of underground communication system where these actors are sharing information with each other, understanding what tactics are working, what tactics aren't working. They call them updates. And so like what updates are hitting now that are being successful. The most recent big one was right around the time when COVID hit with the CARES Act, when that was passed. We saw a lot of these guys pivot over to unemployment fraud because that was the big update that was netting them literally billions of dollars at the time. And so social engineering is, you know, what they've grown up with. What's really interesting is when you look at social engineering, when you look at phishing, when you look at any type of cyber threat and what's being exploited, it's kind of the same thing every single time, right? It's, you know, exploiting the a human being's inherent desire to trust what they see, right? Exploiting anxiety, exploiting fear. This is like the telltale signs of nearly every phishing attack that's out there. And what's really interesting is it's the exact same thing that has been used to con people, human beings, for literally thousands of years. As long as human beings have been on this planet, and as long as we've been communicating with each other, we've been socially engineering each other. The only difference is now we're doing it through a computer or over email instead of doing it face-to-face or over the phone or through the mail or something like that. But the same concepts that are used in BEC attacks today are the exact same concepts that have been used in romance scams, in 419 scams, that are the same concepts that are used in credential phishing attacks, that are the same concepts that have been used for Ponzi scams, 100 years ago, right? So that's really, when we talk about these actors' ability to understand how to exploit human behavior and what buttons to push, it's because they've had literally decades of experience, and there's a really robust ecosystem of information sharing among the community.
I'm curious, Crane, how does automation come into effect when you're talking about cyber criminals either performing recon or actually, carrying out an attack? Is there tooling involved? Or, through your investigations, have you been able to determine how an attack like BEC is executed?
So, what's really interesting about this, and we've had this discussion on my team for a number of years, is the scale of BEC would make you think that there is likely some component of automation behind the scenes. However, based on what we've seen, directly, indirectly, having conversations with some of these guys overtly and covertly, almost all of this activity, regardless of whether it's the recon to identify and then process and validate sort of their targeting leads to the actual attacks themselves when they may be sending out hundreds of emails at a time, that is almost always done manually. So you have someone who's there at a computer sending individual emails to various employees working off of a list, changing the display name manually over and over and over again. And it's always been so surprising to us that that's the case, because I think most people who have, an entry-level understanding of just basic scripting could probably automate a lot of this activity. But for some reason, they don't. And I don't think it's because a lot of these actors don't have the technical sophistication. A lot of these guys, are actually graduates of good universities with really good degrees. Sometimes they're technical degrees in places like Nigeria. For some reason, they just don't automate it. And I don't really have the answer to why that is. We just know, just based on everything that we've seen, there is very little automation behind the scenes in a lot of today's BTC attacks.
That's interesting. Have you looked at GPT-3 or some of these other natural language generators that are becoming available?
We have not, no. And really, I don't think a lot of these other guys have looked at them either. When you look at the complexity of most BEC attacks, they keep it as simple as humanly possible to maximize their profits. They share templates with each other, what they call formats, where, they're sharing these templates that are essentially the first, second, third communications back and forth between the attacker and the target. And that's about as complex as they get. You can really tell as you draw some of these engagements out where those templates end, because you can see the structure of their communication really starts changing as they have to actually improvise on the fly. I don't think that they would ever get into today's BEC actors, I don't think would ever get into the game of, using natural language processing or trying to use machine learning to craft super sophisticated emails, because quite frankly, they don't really need to. Now, that being said, we do see some new players, I think, entering the BEC space, actors that are coming from places like Russia and Israel that are much more sophisticated. They're still sort of entrenched in the sort of more pure social engineering aspect of it. But, I think it's certainly going to come a time where you have, actors that may be involved in things like ransomware that might pivot over to the BEC space here in the next 12 to 18 months, primarily because, ransomware has gotten so much attention over the past year or so. And because cryptocurrency drives so much of that activity, not because of its value, but because it allows for relatively frictionless transactions to go back and forth of large amounts. And because there's been so much attention paid to ransomware, have countries all over the world that are proposing, dozens of various cryptocurrency regulations, which is going to sort of insert more friction into those transactions. And I think the more friction you insert there, the less of an ROI ransomware will actually be. And it's all based on the financials of it. My opinion, I think we're going to start seeing some actors that have been in the ransomware space pivot over to BEC, where they're essentially adapting their malware to, instead of look for initial network access, look for email access. And then you have scaled, essentially, vendor email compromise attacks, which are the most impactful and lucrative form of BEC we see today.
When you look at the stats from Verizon, DBIR, and IC3, it's like BEC and ransomware are sort of like neck and neck in terms of the top revenue producers for criminals, it seems like. A question I get a lot is about deepfakes. And do you have any sense on if this is one of those technologies that might be incorporated in the near future?
So we have seen instances where deepfake audio has been used in BEC attacks, essentially as a way to pivot off of email onto the phone and sort of validating the voice of an executive. We've seen a few examples of that. It is nowhere near widespread or used very frequently. Obviously, when it happens, it gets attention because it's really interesting, but it's not something that's being used at scale. Because again, this goes back to thinking of cybercrime, thinking of BEC as a business. And in order for them to pull something like that off, you have to be able to prove that the ROI is there, right? So if I can just send somebody an email, ask them to send me money, and they send me $10,000, like that's really easy. But if I have to send someone an email, ask them to pivot over to the phone, make sure I'm getting a voice print of the actual executive, so I have to go out and get that work and find sort of the audio of an executive I'm going to be impersonating that I'm going to be using deepfake audio against. Like, there's a lot of work that goes into those types of attacks. And so unless the ROI is there, you're not going to see that, you know, to any certain degree. We probably will continue to see it, you know, here and there in the future, but I don't think it's going to be something that is going to be super widespread anytime soon.
How cognizant are the attackers of the defense mechanisms that organizations here are implementing, or even software solutions that are being developed currently to prevent or slow down an attack? Do you feel like they have sort of an intel into that shifts their approach as they, you know, develop their attack method? Or do you feel like they are just, you know, taking a shot in the dark?
I don't think they're taking a shot in the dark. They definitely pay attention to tactics that are working and what are not working. You know, we see actors all the time testing new things, really just to see if they'll stick, to see if they'll work, you know, really obscure things that, you know, you never would have thought of. We'll see here and there that never really become anything. But we'll see them test things out. And, you know, it's also very similar to sort of the evolution we've recently seen in the BEC threat landscape. You know, so there is, you know, there's this big sort of shift that's happened over the past year where you have actors that, you know, since BEC's inception, have impersonated internal executives, employees, and things like that. And we've seen this interesting shift where third-party impersonations have become essentially the most common form of BEC today. So whether it's through vendor email compromise attacks or even blind third-party impersonation attacks where an attacker is just impersonating a random third party, sometimes it's like a law firm or a debt collector. While BEC attacks are still getting through existing sort of traditional email defenses, it's pretty clear that there's been an acknowledgement and, you know, some attackers have taken notice that, you know, some of the training that we've done to teach people to look out for these executive impersonation attacks may be working to the point where they're not as successful. So now they're moving to these third-party impersonation attacks. The other great example of them sort of understanding and trying new things is one of the other bigger threats that I think we'll start seeing here in the near future that we've started to see more recently in cases like with Twilio and with Uber, where you have attackers that are using non-email attack vectors to compromise accounts and then pivoting those compromised accounts back into email, compromising email and other cloud applications, because, you know, all of those sort of, whether it's SMS or whether it's WhatsApp or whether it's some other messaging app, the ability to detect inbound attacks to those forms of communication is not nearly as mature as all of the defenses we have on email. And so, and also now that we were seeing more and more legitimate business communication go back and forth in things like SMS and WhatsApp, you know, it's not out of the ordinary for an employee to get one of these messages on their personal device. And then the defenses on something like a mobile devices, you know, to detect phishing pages aren't there like they are on corporate laptops. And so that's sort of the next evolution that, you know, that we've seen some attackers start employing, that I think all comes from the, you know, the recognition that they've seen that email-based attacks are, you know, they're still obviously successful, very successful, as we've seen, as Matt mentioned, with like the DBIR and through the FBI IC3 report, we can see how many billions and billions and billions of dollars are being lost through email-based attacks. But as those offenses mature, the attackers are always going to be pivoting in another direction to try to increase their profits, increase their success rates, and always stay one step ahead of defenders. Because that's what the name of the game has been for decades at this point. It's always been this cat and mouse game, and trying to, you know, they make a change, we then sort of patch that up, and then they adapt, and sort of it's always back and forth.
The endless arms race.
Definitely.
So you mentioned pivoting, and since we're running up on time here, I want to pivot this conversation just slightly.
Yeah.
Are you able to share with us what region of the world that you're located in?
Yeah, so I'm down in South Carolina of the U.S., down in Charleston, South Carolina.
Awesome. So say if I were traveling to that region and I was looking for a unique bar experience, where would you direct me to?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'll tell you. So, you know, having two kids, going out to bars is something that I have very little time with in my life these days. But I'll tell you, you know, there's probably not one to recommend, but downtown Charleston is, you know, we're talking about culinary places of the world. There are so many great places to eat downtown and drink that I don't think you would ever have a hard time finding a good spot to land.
Gotcha.
To land at night.
So I just heard last call here. do you have time for one more?
Absolutely.
If you decided to open up a cybersecurity themed bar, what would the name be and what would your signature drink be called?
Oh, man. So I'll tell you. So internally, we've always talked about naming conventions for threat groups that we track. And, you know, one of the things that I always hate about a lot of naming conventions and the names of like threat groups is that they don't make any sense. They have no relationship with what they're actually talking about. So whatever I would name my bar, there would be some actual meaning to it. I would say, you know, something around, so, you know, we call our internal tool set Artemis. You know, after the Greek god of the hunt, primarily because we, you know, a lot of what we're doing is sort of hunting for actors and stuff like that. So I would probably, it would probably be some witty Greek mythology take on cybersecurity, maybe something around Artemis. And then my drink. Oh, that's a real tough one. Gosh, I don't know what my drink would be called, but it would definitely have to do something with, probably include some amount of Mountain Dew, which is so stereotypical, of a cyber researcher.
Yeah.
But, you know, Mountain Dew got me through college and got me through a lot of the boring times at the first parts of work, and still gets me through work today because I've always, you know, we always need a good pickup. So, that would be my answer for that one.
I love it, man. Because as a threat researcher, you have to be alert 24/7.
Absolutely. All the time. I don't know what kind of liquor actually goes with Mountain Dew. So I don't know if I would advise anyone to actually drink it, but if I had to think about it, that's what I'd say.
It could be a non-alcoholic bar. You just serve Mountain Dew.
I'll tell you, I went to a place when I was working for the government. I went to a place that was had vending machines stocked with every flavor of Mountain Dew you could ever imagine. And it was so stereotypical, given the building I was in, I've never seen it anywhere else. But it was just a Mountain Dew vending machine with like six different flavors of Mountain Dew. It was kind of interesting.
That's serious. Yeah.
So maybe it's like, yeah, just take Mountain Dew shots at the bar. That'd be interesting.
They'll just be wired.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome, Crane. Well, thanks so much for joining me and Matt today. Where can our listeners find you and connect with you online?
Yeah, so you can always connect with me on Twitter. I'm at Crane Hassled. Also, you know, if anyone's, you know, interested in learning more about the research that my team does at Abnormal Security, we actually have a website called Abnormal Intelligence where we post all of our sort of external content, whether it's, you know, strategic blog posts or more in-depth threat intelligence reports, or tactical attack library samples. At intelligence.abnormalsecurity.com. It's a place where it's purely meant to be a community resource where we're sharing information. So it's not a place where you're going to go and sign up and then get hounded by sales guys afterwards. It's all about sort of information and intelligence sharing, which is a site that I've wanted to build for some time now, and we just released it a couple of months ago. So that's intelligence.abnormalsecurity.com.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Take care and be safe, man.
Thanks, guys.
As you know, Barcode is where security and IT professionals hang out after a long day. So get your message front and center to our fans by sponsoring an episode. Learn more at thebarcodepodcast.com/sponsor. Cheers.
Unfortunately, it's time to shut the bar down for this episode. Thanks for stopping in. See you next time. We'll save you a seat. Be sure to check us out at thebarcodepodcast.com.